Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Australia's been leading the world in tobacco control for quite a while now, most notably with the passage of our plain packaging legislation in 2011 and the subsequent wins in court against the tobacco industry. But is it time for us to have another crack at the industry that still kills 15,000 Australians every year? Dr. Ross McKenzie, a lecturer in health studies at Macquarie University, says yes. He's my special guest today. Ross and a couple of his colleagues have written a perspective for the MJA on the possibility of suing Big Tobacco for the recovery of healthcare costs. You can find their article at mja.com.au from Monday, the 20th of November, 2017. Australia's got one of the lowest smoking rates in the world, so what are we worried about?
Well, compared to other countries, Australia is doing really well, and this is something I start a lot of my lectures with. But then I come back to what is the situation still. You know, the ABS and the National Drug Strategy Household Surveys have the figure for smoking between 14.5% or 12.8% respectively. You know, so it's in that area.
Yeah.
Certainly much lower than it was, you know, even 1998 when it was still 27%.
So we're still talking about 2 million adults or so, aren't we?
Yeah, it's about 2.5 million is the sort of estimate. So there's still a lot of people smoking, and there are still 15,000 people dying every year of, you know, completely preventable diseases, which is a huge figure for a population of, you know, roughly 25 million people. And they're all completely preventable, of course. So that's, you know, that's the kind of human toll of smoking that remains.
What's the financial burden on the healthcare system?
Well, this is the other big issue. The figure we use in tobacco control often is the one that was published by Lapsley and Collins in 2008, and this is the figure that's used pretty much universally. You know, it's used by government, it's used by the Department of Health on their website, but they calculated, and there is a specific sort of calculation they did. In that it includes not just direct costs, but indirect costs. So, you know, impacts on households, say if the key income earner dies, what does that mean in terms of bringing in childcare? What does it mean in terms of possibly having to move to another area, increasing transportation costs? Getting home help because people who die of smoking-related cancers, for instance, you know, don't die quickly in those cases. So the figure they came up with was $31 billion annually. But that figure, we think, is actually quite outdated. And well, I understand that they're doing a new study, but that's going to take quite a while. But last year, I think it was in 2016, Martin Bowles, the secretary of the Department of Health secretary, who recently resigned, he said he didn't exactly know what the figure would be, but just given, you know, the rising cost of healthcare, inflation, et cetera, he said the cost would be significantly higher than that. And, you know, $50 billion has been bandied around now as the annual cost, and completely unnecessary.
I mean, I know in the past we've had big successes with public health campaigns and legislation restricting advertising and obviously plain packaging. Is there a danger we get complacent after we have a success like that?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that got us thinking about this. This is a point that's been raised by Mike Dobb, who's been you know, instrumental in tobacco control for ages now, and is, you know, rightly internationally recognized for his efforts. You know, his point is that you can sort of, after you have a really big win, not only is there some exhaustion amongst the tobacco control community and,
yes,
and, you know, affiliated government workers, there's kind of a policy inertia. You feel like, oh, yeah, we've done that. And particularly plain packs, which, you know, absolutely massive regulation, a real win for health in Australia. You know, things have happened like this in the past. You know, after a lot of the regulation that came in the late 80s and early 1990s, there was kind of a lull after that, a sense of things have been done. But the tobacco industry never takes that attitude. You know, they're incredibly sophisticated and aggressive. And so, yeah, there's absolutely that fear that among some people in tobacco control that we can't really let up. We have to maintain the momentum, you know, try and get this figure of 15,000 people dying every year down. And it's kind of a good, coincidentally, it's quite a good time because the National Tobacco Strategy comes to an end next year. So people are starting to talk about what's next.
Yeah.
And there are a number of things that people have mentioned, you know, more specific attention paid to indigenous populations,
yep.
To people with mental health issues who have a disproportionately high smoking rate. You know, try and convince governments to keep funding, you know, the broadcast media ads, which have been proven to work very effectively. But, you know, and this is sort of the crux of our paper. One thing that we think should be considered, you know, we're not advocating that the government takes action tomorrow, but we would like, you know, the state and Commonwealth governments to really think about litigation to recover healthcare costs.
Yeah.
It seems like a very good time because of a number of factors, including, you know, the end of the current NTS, the situation in Canada where mm-hmm. litigation is ongoing. You know, the industry is slightly on the defensive in some ways. They've had a few legal setbacks internationally.
That's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah, it's terrible. with a couple of notable exceptions, there seems to be really bipartisan support in Canberra for, you know, controlling tobacco use. So it seems like a pretty fortuitous time to give this some real thought.
You mentioned Canada. Talk us through what's been going on there and what lessons we can learn from that.
This is, again, something that's really, I think, relevant. You know, the U.S. is where this sort of litigation has happened in the past, where, you know, the states famously in the, I think it started in 1994 and the settlement was 1998, the Master Settlement Agreement, which gave the states over $200 billion. And this was to, you know, to recover healthcare costs. But there are, of course, you know, very huge, major differences between the American legal system and the Australian legal system.
Yes.
That made contemplating similar legislation, similar litigation quite tricky because, you know, they have contingency fee arrangements in the U.S. All of that, you know, it's a very, very different system. Massive awards, things that just aren't really that well established, or if established at all, they're not really that well understood in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different system. Canada is, you know, again, it's not identical, but it's much more similar to the Australian system. They have many more kind of fundamental principles that they share.
Yeah.
And so the Canadian situation does seem much more relevant to the sort of things that Australia could expect. British Columbia was the first province to make a claim, and the industry automatically questioned the constitutionality of that. British Columbia subsequently passed legislation which enabled it to take action to recover healthcare costs, and this was upheld by the Canadian Supreme Court. So that, you know, it's just one example of what Australia can take away from what's happening in Canada. It's going to take one of the states, obviously one of the, you know, I would say the more populous, wealthier states, to start the process. And you can learn from everything that's happened in Canada. You know, if say it was New South Wales who took the initiative, you know, they could see that this is exactly what's going to happen if we make this claim without first putting in place legislation that guarantees that it's a constitutional act. So put the legislation in place first and then make the claim. And then if the tobacco industry challenges it, as they almost inevitably would, it would go directly to the Supreme Court, I would imagine. You could cut out a lot of time by streamlining the process based on the lessons that the Canadian provinces have learned. Once the Supreme Court upheld British Columbia's right to pursue this action,
mm-hmm.
The other provinces have all fallen in line. So now that all 10 provinces are suing the industry, you'd have to make sure, it's critically important, this is another lesson in Canada, you have to keep the parent companies in the action. You can't let them distance themselves because, you know, the three companies here are, you know, they still make, I think it's something like $2.5 billion in revenue a year, but they are fairly small in the grand scheme of the global tobacco industry. And they would just file for bankruptcy very, very quickly.
Yes.
So you've got to keep BAT and Imperial and Philip Morris, which is another thing the Canadian provinces were able to do.
Is it a good enough idea to warrant the effort it's going to take?
I think it is. There's some very practical reasons, and there are also some, points of principle or philosophical reasons, if you will. I mean, the practical reasons are healthcare costs are enormous. You know, it's just that's just a given. Provinces looking for $50 or $60 billion, even if it takes 10 or 15 years, that's a huge amount of money, and that's really going to help state and Commonwealth health planning. Going for healthcare costs is, as one of my colleagues, Eric Grisley, describes it, is kind of a way of dealing retrospectively with tobacco industry wrongdoing. Tobacco control measures we bring in today are about the future. And I think he puts it quite nicely. You know, he said there is a continuum of industry wrongdoing, and trying to recover funds to compensate for what they've done in the past really does sort of address that continuum. The lessons learned are really important. The fact is, it would be complex. It would be difficult. It would inevitably draw, just as Plain Pax did, draw a lot of people in government, in NGOs, academia, into this one project. That's inevitable. But that's simply the reality of dealing with a much better resourced opponent. You know, that's how things work, dealing with giant corporations.
And we're pretty good at that now.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. And there have been successes. You know, the industry's lost all of its plain packaging challenges.
Yeah.
It lost a decision in the European Court of Justice recently. It's not easy. It wouldn't happen overnight. BC has been, it's been 17 years since they started the action. The industry will do everything they can to delay it and to test the resolve of the parties, you know, going after the money. But it does work. There is a history of this sort of action working, and I think British Columbia and the other provinces, I think, are going to be a really important moment in tobacco control, because I'm pretty confident they're going to win. Maybe the key message is that it's incredibly complex and it may take a long time, but it's worth doing. You know, the U.S. tobacco industry is airing its corrective statements on television in the U.S. starting this month. And that was something that was ordered in 2006 by Judge Kessler in the RICO case. So it can take a long time.
Yeah.
But, I think it can happen. We shouldn't worry about being in any sort of conflict with class action suits. You know, they're absolutely legitimate as well. It's just two different groups that are being tried to be protected or compensated, you know, the public purse in one case and individual smokers. The reality is the Australian government's paid out untold hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in healthcare costs directly associated with smoking. This has happened, and if we don't sue them, we're kind of letting the tobacco industry away with something that they knowingly created and knowingly generated. There's some interesting literature recently, you know, coming out of the States where, you know, the people are saying, well, we can either just wring our hands and throw our hands in the air because these corporations are so massive, or we can do with our limited resources, you know, and there are ways. We have to be creative and clever. And I think going after the industry, I think the real lesson, if we could do this in Australia, the money would be great, but I think it would really sort of stamp on people that the idea that this industry is completely, you know, corrupt, essentially, you know, and has knowingly created this product and made billions of dollars. I mean, even in the small Australian market, revenues are still $2.5 billion, and they don't even produce here anymore. You know, there's no jobs involved anymore. You know,
they don't like Australia much.
No, we should make them dislike us even more.
Exactly. Thanks, Ross.
Thank you very much.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.